This program was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
Hello, and you're welcome to the first episode of the brand new series, The Street Down Memory Lane. In this series, we'll bring you on a walking tour of one of Ireland's oldest and most historical towns, stopping off to speak to some local characters and historians along the way, while also visiting some landmark buildings. In what we hope will be an entertaining, informative, and of course enjoyable series, we look back at the Yall of yesterday and compare it to the Yall of today. We will document the changing face of the town from the 1950s onwards, as we hear how the retail and manufacturing side of the town has both declined and evolved, while also looking at the significant cultural change that has taken place in the town. In our first episode, we concentrate on the Strand area of the town. We will take in some of the sights and sounds of the area and meet some interesting characters along the way. We also have a few interesting buildings to visit on our journey. We are now here on Claycastle Beach, looking out at the wonderful panoramic view of the Yall Strand area and the new eco boardwalk. And I'm now joined by former Town Councillor Barbara Murray, who is one of the driving forces behind securing the boardwalk for the town.
Now famous Yall Boardwalk. Now that was going back to the Yall Town Council
Yall
time,
Town
in
Council,
your term,
yeah.
And the councillors at that time. Can you tell me how the concept of it came about and the development of it?
That would have been part of a Yall regeneration plan, I think maybe 2020, but there was a lot of stuff going on. There was a lot of visionary items put in the plan, and some have happened. The boardwalk, it all starts with a feasibility study with CCAD for a 400 metre boardwalk. The idea being a boardwalk, being eco-friendly, the days of concrete were well and truly gone. I don't think any of us realised how much of a success it would be and how prevalent walking and cycling would become. I don't think if you were to ask people 10 years ago, or even 15 years ago maybe, you know, or say that tourism is going to be very much about walking and cycling. This is where it's all at now. People are looking to do different things, and it's not all about the pubs, and it's not all about providing other amenities. It's about health and well-being. It's huge.
A boardwalk it is, and showing off the beautiful panorama of our beautiful beach and strand and harbour here. But it was also connecting the front strand then with the Claycastle car park.
Yeah.
It was doing that 400 eco boardwalk was joining both of them together, which was brilliant.
When we did the feasibility study, we did it with a long-term vision, and the long-term vision was that it was to go as far as Red Barn. The feasibility study was done based on say 1200 metres, but obviously we had to divide it up due to costs and so on. The funding was provided by Fault Ireland and the Town Council at the time, and so the first 400 metres was done. Unfortunately, 2 years later, we had that awful storm. I'll never forget the devastation coming down here and looking at it and thinking, oh God, you know, maybe during the lads, we'd be able to find them somewhere and they'll come out and they'll start taking... I was being naive that they'd take the bits away before they'd be washed away. But we got the second storm that night, and
that's
literally
right.
It took off. There was bits of the boardwalk, you know, appearing everywhere. And it was devastating. It was absolutely awful. I have to say, David Stanton deserves a word of credit here in that he was the one that would have pushed with Michael Ring at the time that to ensure that we'd get the funding to reinstate what we had. So that was done, and it was done very, very quickly. There was no downtime. You know, it was done very quickly.
Boardwalk 2 now, as we're looking at it, it had a better structure underneath, back to its former glory, I suppose.
What was done was timber groins were removed and replaced with a steel frame, and the hardwood planks then were now attached to this. I suppose, really, you know, to be thinking ahead and thinking of how bad a storm was it going to be able to withstand, you know, nobody envisaged that it would fall apart that easily, but it did. And obviously then, with the new structure, it made a difference. I explained to people that they can go down into the car park, turn left, you're on the boardwalk, you go from that to the front strand, to the prom, and you can continue walking all the way on footpath, all the way to town. It's huge because you're not walking on sand. And when you get to a certain age group, you mightn't realise it yet, but the knees and the hips start giving out. Walking on sand is not the most pleasurable. It's fabulous, and especially I think for older people that may not be as mobile as they were, or that they're in a wheelchair, that is there for them.
The front strand buildings sit proudly overlooking the beach. To discuss their fantastic history and architecture, we are now joined by Rose Royal.
Can you tell me about the buildings all along this Front Strand area? And I think you're actually saying it, the Front Strand is actually divided up or something in days of old.
That's right. The Front Strand is known as Bayview Terrace and the Front Strand. And it's 24 houses that were built around 1860, 1864 by a man called David Leopold Lewis. And David Leopold Lewis was a speculator who came over from England. He had an address in 18 Harley Street in London, and he was involved in the Cork Yall Railway Company. The Cork Railway Company was founded in 1852. Isaac Butt was the chairman. He wanted to improve the drooping prosperity of Yall, right. And he wanted to get things up and running again, right, via communication and works. Brilliant.
Was the railway just slightly before the stand houses, yeah, as we know them, yeah, or were they kind of, did they go simultaneously?
Much the same time, because the railway opened around 1860, and the houses were built just after that. And the function of the railway was to bring visitors in, right, but it was also to transport bricks from the great brickworks, right, along the river, right, back up to Cork.
All right.
They were also used in these buildings here.
He was an investor.
He'd bought all the property from the 7th Duke of Devonshire back, right, in around 1858, right, 1860. Right. This man bought it for 60,000. Unfortunately, his run of good luck didn't last.
Right.
So by 1868, he was unable to pay, and then he went into bankruptcy.
Right. Front Strand proper was going from where to where?
The Front Strand, I suppose, really is, at this stage, we'd call the area from the railway station up to, towards the swimming pool, the Front Strand.
Was the Front Strand. And beyond that then was...
We have behind it Dysart, where there was a castle, right, in the 1840s first edition map, somewhere around Dysart Lodge. But by and large, looking at the earlier maps, there was nothing much out the Front Strand, except maybe around the railway station, there could have been cabins, because we were outside the town.
The people that moved here then, obviously they were affluent.
My understanding was, when I bought the house here, that it was somebody from Collins Barracks that lived here. So that it seemed that it was army officers had summer houses here.
Right,
and
right,
you had the bells downstairs for the maids.
Right.
You had your stoves down. All the cooking was done down there. And then upstairs you had it was definitely a very upstairs downstairs, and at the back of some of the houses still there's some stables.
All right, so there was a military influence of some
personnel, right, lived down here, summer houses, okay, I'd imagine.
And so, and you can imagine, you know, with the phenomenon of Downton Abbey, I have this vision like of what we wrote with upstairs, downstairs,
yeah,
and Mr. Hudson and Mr. Bridges and all that kind of stuff. And was there a bell? Is there a bell in your living here? In one is there
when we came first about 30 years ago, right, yeah, downstairs there was a row of bells,
right,
but the wires had corroded,
right,
but you go into some of the houses up here and they're all slightly different, right, but there were bell pulls,
right,
at the side of the fireplace pull, and the maid would appear with tea.
Rose, would you be Mrs. Bridges, or would you be living in the upstairs?
I'd say I'm Mrs. Bridges. I'm always in the kitchen.
Can you tell me about the style and the architecture of the different houses along the Front Strand?
Yeah, they're a very typical Victorian, double-fronted, meaning there's a door in the middle and two windows on either side. There's a lot of detailing going on here, and there's on either side of most doors there's decorative stonework made of very soft sandstone, which is eroded really because of where we are. But all the houses are brick, and a lot of the houses are plastered because some of the brickwork wasn't meant to be exposed, because maybe it was a poor type of brick. But they're very generous style houses, high ceilings. They had the best of pitch pine floors, lovely pine shutters, and timber windows. And my own windows here are 160 years old,
right,
and they're still going. The one thing is, yes, they you do have to maintain them and paint them, which isn't easy.
So the people of old, rather than popular belief now, is they were well ahead of the curve in their environmental
thinking. They're very sustainable altogether, because they built things to last.
Yes.
Radio interview, but I ended up alone at the microphone. seagulls are still out of
reach. As we venture further in towards the Strand, we meet Tommy Dilliker. Tommy's great-grandfather, along with the Strand community, helped build the early flood defence systems with hand shovels. No doubt, Tommy has other tales to tell as well.
Roughly how long are you there, Tom?
Well, there were a couple of generations. Tom and Noni would have been my parents. Their parents was Michael and Mary Kate, and she was Mary Kate Slattery.
And was that in McCurtainstown as we know it
in
now,
McCurtainstown as we know it, yeah.
Before that, for the Civil War, I think it was called Williamstown?
After William of Orange. And then they changed it to the Moss McCurtain, McCurtainstown.
Right, after the Irish Patriots.
Yes.
There was a bit of a nickname for people from that particular area and a little bit of stretch of beyond that. Can you tell me what the nickname of what it was?
The Rockies were from the lighthouse out.
That was the name of the people living there, they called them
yes,
the Rockies.
Yes, yeah, the Rockies.
All right. Why was that?
Diving rocks, and the rocks were in the Strand.
Tom, can you recall any people that lived along the area you were in?
Well, in my father's time, there were the Lachlans, Mulcahys. They were great names in McCurtainstown in the day. Later years, then we had Mrs. Hurley, who was one of our latest legends that passed.
It's nice to see that there's a plaque in honour of her name there,
yes,
at the end of the
Yeah, it is nice to have. We had Jim Morrison as well, who was a great collector for music, and he lived out near the Greyhound track of his collection of John McCormack.
John McCormack, all the old 78s and stuff,
yes,
as
yeah,
we call
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah.
Before the pop music, as we call it. Did you work in the old Perks, Tom? And do you remember a famous man, Bill Perks, commonly more known as Jumbo?
Jumbo, yeah, I did, yeah. He was a nice guy, character. He called me Al Capone down one time when he found me pulling the sixpences from beneath the slot machine. He gave me a toe in the arse. I hopped my head off the machine.
You never
gently,
did that.
Because the candy floss sticks were longer than the lollipop sticks. And they were new out, so you get the sixpences that were in there for a good while. And so he said, "What are you doing, Al Capone?" I lost my sixpence. He said, "Where did you get a sixpence?" I said, "I found it earlier." That's all I could say. Happy days.
Tom, can you recall any characters again from that era?
Yeah, my dad had a good friend called David Mulcahy, and they were a large family, and there was a step family as well. But David was a bit of a character and a bit of a charmer of the ladies. He was a messenger boy, and on his bicycle one day he met my dad. He called him and said, "Tommy, come here," he said. And he put his bicycle up in the stand and he took out a penknife, and he had a fruitcake to go to one of the doctors out the front Strand.
To the big houses we used.
To the big house, yeah. And he'd bring it out to the parlourmaid. But he cut the cake in half and said, "Tommy, take that home to your house and mind it. I'll be back later and I'll sort it out between us." He's probably still going to confession over it posthumously, you know. He would drop it out to the parlourmaid and she'd have it all sorted, her side of it. And she might give him the doctor's suit then to bring to the laundry. He'd get the use of that suit then that night, going to the Strand Palace. And he'd even get paid up there as well to take the wallflowers out dancing. He'd get a fringe benefit, you know. He'd take the suit into the laundry the following day if they delayed it for another use of it, because sometimes they would take the judge's car, Judge Hurley, who lived out the front Strand, they would take his car and push it up out of the driveway out towards Brosnan's there, push it up out of the driveway and onto the road, push it down the road, and then they'd start it then away from the house and they'd drive to Middleton. They used to be vexed above Middleton with it because of the Gardaí up there at the time would be standing around the car all night to mind it, just to be seen minding the judge's car, not knowing that his right, after being robbed of that, and they would try and get it back to you all before the judge would get up in the morning and have the car parked up. And eventually when the bubble did burst and they were caught, the judge said, "I always knew that car, there was something wrong with the petrol, it was leaking petrol, it was going somewhere, but I never thought this was happening." And I'm quite sure he gave mischief sentence of some sort.
Why didn't you go the whole hog and do three quarters of the cake?
50-50, you know. 50-50.
At the end of the boardwalk, the Strand houses proudly overlook Yall Beach. We meet here Sal Tyvee Perks, daughter of the famous Jumbo Perks, and she's going to tell us about the early days of the Funfair Perks Entertainment Centre. You're celebrating your 90 years, imagine, in the entertainment business.
Yes, we are indeed, and very proud of it. In fact, my father would be absolutely delighted were he here at the time, you know. He would be thrilled that we made it this far. It doesn't seem, time flies, particularly when you're travelling with the funfair and working with the funfair. And our hours were very long. You don't notice the days, the weeks, the years going by.
How had it such an impact on people?
In those days when the funfair were travelling, business was very brisk because the fact that there was no television, radio, very little, but the excitement of the funfair coming to the town was a real big thing. We spent longer in the town, maybe not just 10 days or a weekend, we'd spend maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And in my mother and father's day, maybe 2 months. They would have things like pongo, which is bingo now, and they'd have the spinner, the prize stall, and a lot of stalls which people liked, and particularly the ladies. And then the ride started to come into vogue.
Sal, you keep referring to your father, the famous Jumbo, we know him.
That's right, Jumbo. Bill was his proper name, William. But my grandmother, at least my aunt, Queenie, Auntie Queenie, when my grandmother was expecting my father, she took him to, there was a free day in the Belfast Zoo. She took Auntie Queenie to the zoo and she saw an elephant. So when she loved him, of course, loved him, and his name was Jumbo. And when she got home, anyhow, a couple of weeks later, my father was born, so she said, I have my own little Jumbo, and it stuck to him.
Sal, we're down here now where the old parks, funfair is in the Strand.
Yeah.
And besides that, then, there was the showboat, which you were involved
right.
with, and then later the Strand Palace. These were magnificent dance halls, and some of the best musicians and bands and orchestras played there. Can you remember any of those occasions?
Well, I do. I remember Horslips, Ackerbilk. We had, of course, Mick Della Hunty, and he used to come for 2 months. He used to work on a Sunday, 2 to 5, 7 to 10, and 11 to 2, 3 sessions.
Did you strike up a great friendship?
Oh,
with,
great.
With
sure, he was with 30 years with us, yeah. We knew his whole family, Mary Della Hunty and young Mick Della Hunty. We knew them all very well. They see, the young ones would come to you all, Mary and Mick, and a cousin of theirs called Helen. They'd all come for the season, for the summer, and we'd all knock around together.
For me, as a kid, during the summer, coming out the back road, like everyone walked towards the Strand.
Everyone.
Perks and the front beach. And we used to as kids as well. But before we actually arrived here, we used to hear the music come from the Tannoy. And I remember bands like the Archies over the Tannoy and the Eagles, Beach Boys and Terry
Beautiful
Jacks.
Beach Boys, yeah.
You used to play all that pop music at the time, out there.
Yeah, well, we had big, huge speakers outside, which aren't allowed now, as you know. They used to play all this music, and a lot of the young people used to sit on the wall up there, opposite our place, and listen to the music and talk to the fellas. Like, that was a famous meeting place for them.
It was a meeting spot for the boys meeting the girls
yeah.
meeting the boys. It was how people met up back then. Y'all's Tinder spot then.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Showboat was innovated by my brother, George. He thought he'd, and that was a packer. But they also bought from Mr. Atkins the Strand Palace, and they built their home in the roof of it, and then downstairs, I don't know how many times I called bingo, and thousands of times I called bingo numbers in there. It was bingo and dancing, and then every Thursday night in the summer there was a thing called the Crypt, and that was a disco. Dark and dingy, and they had to take all the stuff. You know, Mr. Fitzgerald?
Jim Fitzgerald.
And he was the fellow that did the Crypt. And that, of course, would be packed with young people and supervised to the last.
We are here in this spot here where we have loads of nostalgic memories of the famous Perks. You've moved from the O'Sall and you've relocated now into the Upper Strand, and that's been magnificent as well for you.
Yes, we've done that, but we were very sad to leave the Pleasure Beach, you know. But we felt when we came back from China, the weather, the public liability, health and safety, all that was totally against us. So we found somebody and he wanted to buy the place from us. So we sold him the land and he built the apartments on it, you know. And win, lose or draw, we had nothing to do with the apartments, just the land. And we went down to our place down here in Seafield, which I love because we're indoors. We're not destroyed with weather. Like even today now, it can still operate like mad.
And that's been a success since you've moved.
Absolutely,
as well.
Even more so, yeah.
And how did it go celebrating your 90th year?
Oh, it was a lovely year, and we just finished with a roller coaster, a family roller coaster, and it did very well. And we got several awards for the 90 years and recognition. So I'm glad today that you're doing exactly the same. That's lovely. And I do love you all. It's my hometown. I love living here, and I wouldn't change. And my boys are the same. They love it too.
Thank you.
As we walk towards town along the beach promenade, we see the train hill where the old Parks was located. This is where the old railway station was located. We're going to talk to Frankie Keane and Sammy Revens about their memories of the train coming to y'all, the characters from the area and the businesses that operated around the place. Frank, this was like a hive of activity, the central place in town years ago.
Well, the Strand was the mecca of y'all down through the ages, you know, wonderful memories of this particular spot. The railway shed was based where we are standing right here now, and great memories, of course, of trains coming in.
The cul-de-sac here at the turntable, and they brought them in by horse and cart, the goods then into town.
That's right. The big broad looms, etc., went by train. Various destinations around the country. The exports of carpets from Yall Carpets. It was big trade. Industrial-wise, Yall was booming, like, you know. I was born in 1948. I can still remember, like, coming out here to the Strand and the activity. And the big thing on a Sunday afternoon was, you know, special trains coming into the station and we giving a hand to turn the turntable. That was a big thing. And I can remember Paddy Sullivan, Jerry Kelly, the Browns. They would be on duty on that Sunday afternoon, and of course it was a wonderful thing, like, to turn the train around.
And did you actually give a hand as a youngster then?
Oh, yeah, that must have been something else. Well, the fact of the matter was, like, you know, we were friendly with the Browns. They were lovely, Jack and Mikey, and they lived over here in the railway cottages. There was two cottages over here, and Mikey Brown in particular. The one thing they would warn you, like, before you would get onto the turntable to turn the train was, they always warned you to be careful, be careful. And of course, if you stepped out of line, you wouldn't be there the following Sunday. You were a danger. The railway yard, was the B trains coming in, the trains going to and fro, like the radio train to Knock. I often travelled in that. The trains to county finals, we travelled in all those trains, and they were chock-a-block.
Frank, can you tell me about the radio train you called?
The radio train to Knock. Well, the radio train from Yall to Claremorris, that was the Knock excursion once or twice per year. And of course, naturally, religion was a big thing in those particular times. My goodness, if you didn't book a ticket in Yall that particular time, you probably wouldn't get a seat for Knock. But on the way up then, they called to Killa, McGeela, Middleton, Carrigtool, before you went into Kent Station, and then the train to Kent Station to Claremorris.
And why was it called the radio train?
Well, the fact of the matter is, it was rosaries the whole way up, prayers the whole way up, from Yall to Knock.
Well, did it come out over a speaker in each carriage?
Oh, yes, yeah, right. Through the whole train. Right. Yeah, like, the train would have six up to ten carriages at times.
All right. And you nicknamed it
and
then the
radio train.
Or the rosary train.
The rosary train. Like, that time it was steam trains, and, like, push your head out the window, of course, and you'd be black. Then, of course, the diesel came in, and, of course, it was faster then, like, you know. It was wonderful to see, like, the coals being shovelled in to keep the fire going and all that type of thing. We witnessed all that. Our youth, I suppose, when we think back in our youth, they stayed with us. This place where we're standing now, the activity that was here, Parks, of course, was the place because Yall for holidays, Parks for pleasure. That was the cant at the time. I still remember the Showboat Express coming into the station here, and it was led by a man by the name of E.P. Stanley. He lived in the Low Road in Cork. He organised all those trains from Cork Kent Station into Yall.
The Showboat Express was a dedicated train, yeah, to bring the passengers down for the dance halls in Strand Palace.
It was called the Showboat Express. When it would arrive here in the station yard, Mick De La Hunty come down to the station yard with his saxophone, and he'd play the crowds up into the ballroom.
It was one happy train of passengers.
Train. Well, undoubtedly, it was wonderful.
Was the case like that film on the town where the three sailors are off on leave and they're looking for Miss Turnstiles? Were you ever out and about looking for Miss Turnstiles?
Well, the one memory I have of here is sitting on the wall opposite Strand Palace and Showboat, watching the girls go by. And it was a great era in the sense because the miniskirt came in. And of course, when the girl went to or fro, her head went left, her head went right.
Song goes, that was a good, occupation to have.
It was indeed, yeah.
Standing on the corner, watching all the girls go by. Brother, you don't know a nicer occupation. Matter of fact,
I've Sammy Revens here. You opened up a successful business out the front stand. Why did you pick the front stand?
Well, I suppose I was working for Michael Cunningham, and at the time it was Dick Curran had the shop, the late Dick Curran, and Dick was about to retire himself, so he was looking for someone to take it over, and Michael decided he'd take it over. That was in 1987. And I suppose I got married in 97 myself, 10 years later, and myself and Kate decided that we'd ask Michael would he sell us the shop after all, because I was the person that was running for so many years. And yeah, I bought the shop, or we bought the shop, and I must say it was a great little business for the length of time I was there, 1999 to 2015. So we decided that we'd sell the business, and you know, for medical reasons, and you know.
But while you were there, it was a great success.
Absolutely.
And you met many friends and industry.
I mean, see, I suppose being in the council as well, my shop then was a constituency office for me. So I had people coming in every day of the week with queries about the council and things like that. And you know, it was great. I was a peace commissioner as well, and I'm a commissioner for roads. So you'll have people coming in, you know, all the time, for looking for different reasons, not just to buy meat, but by the time they were going out of the shop, they were after buying a bit of meat to go out anyhow, like, you know.
And of course you were right near the bus stop as well.
Absolutely, yeah, that was a great bus stop as well, like, you know.
Did you meet many people coming off the bus there, or queuing up for the bus during the height of the summer season?
Every day of the week, just unreal, Mike. I often made coffee for people that were waiting for buses as well. You know, elderly people would come in and they'd ask you then, have you a seat, and I had 3 seats inside the door of the shop so they could sit down, have a cup of tea. Yeah, I met characters. I mean characters now.
Sam, I suppose the Strand is kind of a separate entity to the town in one way. Can you name the shops, the people that were in the Strand area?
I suppose when I went there, when I was there in 87, like, you had Clancy's, which was the railway bar at the time, and then you had the Marine Bar. You had Maureen Welch's shop. Then you had the Cozy Cafe. I think there's Mrs. Howard or someone owns it at the time, which was Jerry Savage's wife, Helen, was the woman that was there, like, you know, I think it was her aunt or something like that. But that was a fabulous establishment. You could go down to the Cozy Cafe for your lunch, and you'd have a 3-course meal for £5 at the time. You get your starter, soup, or whatever it should be. You get a main course, and you get a dessert afterwards, and you'd even get the tea or the coffee thrown in afterwards as well.
In the early 1970s, there was a terrible event where the Atlantic Hotel was burned to the ground. The hotel was located across from Clancy's Bar and Restaurant, as we know it now, across from a curtain stone. The event was captured on film by the late Bobby Chappell, and it was an extraordinary footage. A man who worked for the ESB called Lucky Jim Cronin to prevent further catastrophe. And Noel Cronin now is going to tell me about that famous incident.
Noel, back here where we are in Terra Firma, looking across the road there, just beyond Clancy's, there was the Atlantic and the Pacific Hotels. Now, there was a terrible tragedy of a fire there back in 1972, I believe. Can you recall that?
That's right. I remember the night actually very well. It was 1972, as you rightly say, Mick. There was 2 hotels there. And, of course, naturally, they were very, very busy at the time. But the 2 hotels were amalgamated into one. And in 1972, in the middle of the night, it caught fire. And they literally practically burnt to the ground. But I remember my late father actually was in the ESB at the time. And of course, naturally, the fire brigade at the time rang the ESB to say, look, we cannot douse this fire unless you knock off the electricity supply to it. But the electric wires are coming in at the back of the hotel from, we'd say, the Longville side, you know, up on that side there. And apparently my father had to climb the pole there. And there is a kind of archive footage actually of my father actually on the pole there, cutting off the electricity wires going into the back of the hotel.
Noel, I've seen that archive footage, and it's ironic that Bobby Chappell actually shot that footage.
Bobby Chappell actually was shot that, because Bobby was very much into home movies at the time.
Your dad climbing the pole, it's like the towering inferno behind him.
Well, it was, actually. And when he came home that night, actually, I remember, actually, when he came home that night and the following morning, he always wore a kind of a tweed sports jacket, and there was a pile of holes burnt in the back of it. You know, from the intensity of the fire.
We're here now in the Upper Strand area, and this is where the Seafield Fabrics Limited was, and Blackwater Cottons, both factories employing hundreds of people. The Grotto nearby, the Greyhound Track across the road, and well-known resident from here, Jeannie Shields, is going to talk about his time growing up as a teenager in the 70s and 80s.
Jeannie, you've lived out Strand all your life. Can you tell me, where did your parents come from originally? How did they settle in Yall, going back that far?
Oh yeah, Dad came from Athlone when he was about 16, and
Seafield Gentex used to be up in at Lone at the time, and he was working there himself, and Sean Coyle. The two of them travelled down together, you know, and they started working in Seafield Fabrics, it was called at the time. And there was a guy, R.D. Lord, was the main man in all this business, you know what I mean? He brought it to Ireland, he's an English guy. That guy, anyway, kicked off Seafield Fabrics in Yall, you know, and, you know. Dad was there for about 56 years. He worked in this place, like, but it changed names over the years, you know what I mean? Like, different names. It was Seafield Limited one time, and there was a load of different...
It was fabrics and textiles.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. It changed a good few times. And my mother then was originally from Cork Hill, Queen's Torres. So that was a great combination altogether. We were kind of supposed to be strandies and townies, and it was all... mental stuff.
There's always like and seem to be a north south divide, which right, there is in Yall, yeah. But the Strand End was a separate entity. That's as right. Such I've been told like back in the day, before there's so much travel now and all that kind of stuff, but that everything happened in the town centre, and off that was where it was all happening. But the Strand was a separate entity almost on its own.
It was, McBee. We'd very rarely go into town as young kids, you know what I mean? Unless we were visiting my grandparents, you know. And it was a big thrill going in there, you know what I mean, with all the shops. And going into Merrick's was a big thing at the time, you know. And Pratt's, do you remember that fish and tackle place? That was a great crack altogether. We do all our shopping in the Strand. My mother, Miss O'Neill's place. Do you remember Miss O'Neill's shop down there? We used to call her Mrs. O. She'd more gold on her than a jewellery shop. You know, and she was as bronze, she'd be constantly on holidays, you know, just gas crack altogether.
But that's what I mean, Jean, that you had your own community out there, right, your own shops, your own businesses, right, your own boarding houses and hotels and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I know it was happening in town, but it was also happening out in the Strand, because all roads led to the Strand. Everyone went out to the beach during the summertime. Right, they came down the train and all that kind of stuff. Can you name any more of the shops or the people or the businesses that were out down?
Oh, yeah, there was Dick Curran's, and there was Mrs. Fitzgerald's. Dick Curran was the local butcher, and Sammy took over after Dick moved on, and then there was Fitzgerald's. They used to sell wool, and there was all this crazy, you know, people used to do a lot of knitting that time. And Maureen Welch's shop was kind of a meeting place for all of us, you know what I mean? It was a gas place altogether. I used to meet the Hurleyhead guys and O'Leary's and Gardner's and all the boys, and we'd team up and we'd go down the beach playing soccer. And Jesus, lad, it was fantastic times. It was incredible times, like, as young fellas. Like,
when you played beach soccer, was that in between the breakers?
Oh yeah, in between.
Did you make
breakers.
Your own goalposts like we did with the Ganseys?
We take off our jumpers, like, and we make goalposts, like, and there could be 20 a side or 25 a side, and there'd be load of town gang come out, and there'd be all of us, like, and the age gap was mental. They could have fellas 30 years of age, and the likes of me 10 years of age, and we're trying to play soccer with these guys. And there'd be a riot. The amount of goals didn't matter, because at the last 5 minutes, it was 1-1. Do you know what I mean? And the next goal wins was the thing, like. It was always the next goal wins the match, like.
I believe some of the lads actually got a white marker and they put three stripes on their shoe to make it look like an Adidas or something and stuff like that.
That was well before our time.
You didn't have the Ronaldo €100 t-shirts or anything
Jesus,
like that.
No. We'd have an old mix, like, which would turn into a swimming togs when the tide had come in. Do you know what, the sawn-off jeans, like, remember those ones? Like, the whole place used to be wearing them, like, and the long hair, like, and we all thought we were George Best.
I was cut too.
You see Jumbo here? You don't want Jumbo.
I was the one with the hacksaw blade on the shoe. And I was the one that got a ticky around with Jumbo.
Exactly. Do you remember the moon record, yeah? We used to lift it and drop it and turn our backs every weekend.
So there was the Penny Falls, remember the Penny Falls machine?
Yeah.
So we're here now at the Perks Entertainment Centre in the Upper Strand area of Yall, and we're going to join the warm hospitality of Saltivy Perks and a wonderful staff and the contributors, and we're going to discuss about streets down memory lane. We certainly love our Strand, and you're all part of the Strand community. From where you're from, like, thousands coming to visit us over the, you know, the summer months.
The trains coming to Yall and Sunday in particular, early Sunday morning, were unbelievable. The crowds, me. Sure, we all remember it. It was incredible, wasn't it? Like,
I think I remember there was 15 trains came in of an August bank holiday weekend in the peak of the season. 15 trains coming to Yall. And at Summerfield Bridge, and to crawl into the station then, I suppose, on the grounds of safety, whatever the case may be, at Summerfield Cross, clear picture of the people opening the doors and jumping out and heading up the little embankment and heading down to the beach. They couldn't get enough of the beach. And the trains were packed.
You remember the turntable with the machine, with the locomotive on it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do, yeah.
We all do. And as kids, we'd be running down to get the train driver used to actually, you know, drive the locomotive onto the turntable. And I remember there was one bearing in the middle, and it was so finely balanced, one or two people could just turn it around on the thing. And as kids, we'd always be rushing down to, you know, to push the handle around for the train.
As the kids said, you'd be allowed to do that.
My memories of the turntable, we used to play penny poker underneath the turntable with shelter. But penny poker, the Hurley lads and Joyce's and all these guys, we used to be in under that. Yeah. And of course, the boys, when they were smoking fags, were going under there as well. For the crack, you know, hiding away from everyone. It was some hideout. Like, you could move it
like you
so
said,
easy. So easy. Like, if the lads came along, if somebody knew you were in there, you know what I mean? Like Tommy Delacour or somebody else, and they wanted to frighten the bejesus out of you, he could move it on his own, you know, just push it.
Yeah. We had a steam train and a couple of tons, like, honest, more than a couple of tons.
But the driver himself turned it.
The driver himself used to turn it, actually, finely balanced.
I can remember throngs that were coming off the train, but the men would always wear suits. Going to the beach, like they left the suits, and they had these hankies tied in the four corners on the head for the sun, and these big American ties. You know, that somebody in America sent them home. Big flashy ties. They'd roll up the trousers for the paddle, but they'd be aiming for Clancy's downstairs bar. I can remember we had a monkey called Cheetah and Jackal. The monkeys would get loose and they'd go in, they'd walk along the bar counter and sip out the pints. The fellas from Cork, like, you know, they would have a fit. So my mother would have to go in and take the monkey out, and I'd go with her. Here would be all the fellas, and the wives would be stuck down the beach with the kids. And of course, they'd be locked out of their minds when it was time to go home. But they wouldn't see head, arse nor tail of the beach. They came for Clancy's.
There was another thing, actually, that was peculiar, I think, to the Strand, and I think if any of you remember, actually, the sale of boiling water.
Oh, yes.
You know, everybody, every little nook and cranny and every little commode outlamp, where there was an order up, boiling water, sixpence or something like that, boiling water, threepence or something like that, you know. And you could buy a kettle of boiling water, take it down the beach and have your tea bags and make the tea.
There was a woman out the Strand that time. Was it Nelly Maher was her name?
Yeah. Nelly Maher, yeah.
And she used to sell it all of the time.
Yeah.
Right.
And she was in a carriage, wasn't she?
That's right, yeah.
Gigi's. Good memories, bad memories, Gigi's?
Thrown out of there.
Unbelievable memories, Gigi's.
It was, when it was built with Dandorian that time, I've been told by people who have been nightclubs in New York to Ibiza that there was nothing compared to us.
James O'Keefe, you know, was DJ there, and came to me one day, and he said to me, this new setup is incredible, man. You have to come out during the week. And I said, all right, like, I didn't know what to expect. They were getting it ready for that weekend. I'm not kidding you now, like, I thought I was in a spaceship. I never saw anything like it in my life. The whole town, the whole of East Cork, West Waterford, and arrived sure, the place was chock-a-block for years. Before that, like, and we all remember it, remember the bands, like the Dixies and all that crowd? Sure, I used to be out there, like, incredible when Gigi's arrived.
Like. So, like, the Strand area, it was almost, like, self-contained with what was going on out there, with the magnificent pubs, the businesses, the hotels, the Greyhound track, Gigi's, your place, Sal. You know, it's like a mini town of its own.
Summertime, Gigi's, like, the Strand lit up by day, the beaches were full, Perks was full, and then Gigi's lit up the whole Strand by night.
The local pubs then, when people couldn't get into Gigi's, they'd try and get into the pubs.
Go back before Gigi's, I suppose. The whole Strand was completely self-sustainable because everybody that had a business or a shop or a premises in the town had a corresponding business outside. Like, you had the Mason Fox, the man with the educated fingers. He'd have a barber shop, a haircutting outer. You had Susan Hurley, the Esplanade Hotel out here. And you had, of course, the ABC Cafe, which belonged to the Hurst family. You had so many businesses. Eileen and Paddy Conley had a little shop out here. Eugene O'Sullivan had another little shop out here. Artridge's had a shop out here. You remember all those outlaw. And the Strand was completely vibrant.
Thanks to all the guests and contributors and the people of the Strand area for joining in this wonderful programme by Community Radio Yall. We hope you enjoyed Streets Down Memory Lane.
Sweet your bay, beside your loved waters, I'm longing to stay, and soon I'll return. until that happy day. My heart's in your keeping, so sweet Yarra Bay.
The Street Down Memory Lane was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. Presented by Michael Hussey. Sound engineer, Stephen O'Leary. Sound engineering and editing, Thomas O'Keefe. Produced by Paul Daly. Series producer, Angela Kearns. Researcher, Angela Kearns. We would like to sincerely thank all those who took part in this program for their time, and most of all, for the memories. A Community Radio Yawl production.
Sweet Yawl Bay, beside your love waters, I'm longing to stay. And soon I'll return until then.